Can the climate movement overcome America's systemic racism? Climate One Conversations feature energy companies and environmentalists, Republicans and Democrats, the exciting and the scary aspects of the climate challenge. I'm Greg Dalton. Many white people have recently become aware of how racism is embedded in every aspect of American society. Racism that has been glaringly obvious to people of color their whole lives. And environmental efforts are no exception. Air pollution, severe weather, and the economic upheaval brought on by climate change impacts Black and minority communities first and worst. Refineries, power plants, and dumps are often located in lower-income neighborhoods of color. Those same neighborhoods also often lack green space and stores with healthy food. Yet theirs are the voices often left out of policy responses and market solutions.
We want economically thriving, educated, and healthy, safe communities. And part of the reason why we haven't been able to achieve that is because of the ability not to have brave conversations about the inequalities in this country.
Linda Carr is president and CEO of Higher Heights for America, an organization she founded to grow Black women's political power. For those who have long been working on climate justice, it's been an uphill battle to get people to understand the needs of communities of color.
Anytime policy is being created, it should be coming from local people, local communities, local organizations. And the most important thing was that, you know, communities speak for themselves. So if we can get politicians to understand that basic concept, we would stop wasting money and we would stop making mistakes by creating policy that is not meeting the needs of everyday people.
That's Mustafa Santiago Ali, Vice President of Environmental Justice at the National Wildlife Federation. We're also joined by Dr. Robert Bullard, Distinguished Professor of Urban Planning and Environmental Policy at Texas Southern University in Houston. Dr. Bullard is widely recognized as the father of environmental justice and is a recipient of many awards, including this year's Stephen Schneider Award for Outstanding Climate Science Communication, presented by Climate One. We begin by connecting with our breath. People breathe about 25,000 times a day, and we usually take it for granted. COVID-19, which attacks the lungs, and the suffocation of Eric Garner and George Floyd at the hands of police, have focused on breath and given it new meaning. Mustafa Santiago Ali explains why.
You know, breath is life. You know, from the moment that we come from our mothers, the first thing we do is take that breath, which brings life into our bodies in this world. And unfortunately, we know that so many of our communities, Black communities, brown communities, indigenous communities, sometimes even lower wealth white communities, don't have that opportunity. And they don't have that opportunity because there is intentionality by folks both in the past and in the present and limiting folks' ability to be able to take that breath. And that's why in this moment, we also talk about that racism, systemic racism, plays into that paradigm and to that set of actions. And hopefully today we will unpack what that looks like and how we can rectify the situation that has been perpetuated by both politics, policy, and in everyday folks' lives.
Glenda Carr, when you take a long, deep breath, you know, how does that affect you, given what's everything that's been happening in our country lately about breathing?
Yeah. So recently, a colleague of mine shared a song that her mother-in-law wrote. And it was a song in tribute to George Floyd. And in that, she says, "I can't breathe. Let me breathe. Hear me." And I think those three short phrases shares a little bit about how African-Americans are feeling in this moment, how Black and brown communities are feeling in this moment, and frankly, how the world is feeling. You know, the notion of being able to be free to take a full breath and use this moment for those who can to fill up and fill our democracy in a way that can envision a pathway forward. It is a luxury, unfortunately, in our society to breathe. The attack on Black and brown lives and our ability to not only breathe because we've been constrained by institutional racism for centuries. Our ability to breathe when we continue to see police brutality choking Black lives, our ability to breathe so we can imagine a world rid of pollution, rid of racism, rid of a politically toxic, racially divisive time that we're living in. But in that moment, when we breathe, there's clarity about a pathway forward.
Dr. Bullard, your thoughts. You've been writing books with very prescient titles, Dumping in Dixie, The Wrong Complexion for Protection. When you think about breathing and the work you've done, what really fills your mind and your heart?
Well, you know, the first thing I think of is that breathing is natural. And what's unnatural is when breathing can be hazardous to your health. And for too long, our lives have been snuffed out and somehow demeaned because we have not been allowed to breathe freely. And I think this whole idea of the right to breathe clean air is a basic human right. And when you start taking away that right to breathe, you're taking away humanity. And when you're taking away just every day, 24/7, the violence of dumping pollution into neighborhoods through smokestacks, and families are waking up 2:30 in the morning because some accident, because of some plume that is rushing through their neighborhoods. They don't know if, and they're told to shelter in place, and they don't know if they're going to live or die. That's violence. It's the same kind of violence that we see, the police violence that's snuffing out Black lives and killing people and creating this mental stress and trauma. When we see those videos daily, and running, looping, that is causing trauma, you know, which is PTSD. That kind of violence is taking its toll. And I think everybody knows it now. These demonstrations are really showing that, not just in this country, around the world, that this is unjust, this is barbaric, and we need to stop it right now.
Mustafa Santiago Ali, I was recently listening to an interview with Brian Stevenson, and he was talking about how going to other countries, particularly, I guess, Germany, how they actively encourage people to learn about the Holocaust. There's this national reckoning across generations. And it seems like this country hasn't had that reckoning yet. I'd like to hear your thoughts on whether America's really put this legacy of racism front and center like it should have.
Well, I think America's afraid to, because if you put it front and center, if you integrate it into the educational system as a part of our history, both the dark days and where we are in this present moment, then you have to do something about it. And it's very difficult for America to admit that it was a part of genocide for our indigenous brothers and sisters. It's hard for America to also talk about snatching the lives of Africans and bringing them to this country so that you could have free labor. It's difficult for our country to also focus on the fact that they brought Chinese brothers and sisters over here to build the infrastructure on the railroads and then turn their back on them after that and ostracize them. So for America to truly be able to highlight the injustices, the systemic racism that we're talking about today, would then mean that you also have to figure out a way that you are going to address both those past and present injustices that continue to happen. And that may come in the form of reparations. That may definitely come in the form of making sure that there is legislation, both on the federal and the state level, that rectifies those situations. And that also means that there has to be resources placed into that overall equation, because words without resources have little meaning. So I think it's difficult for our country up to this moment to be able to actually honor the lives that have been sacrificed so that this country could be in the positioning that it is. But I will also say that this is a new moment. This is a new time. And young people and many others are refusing to have the 21st century look like the previous centuries. So we have to see what that's going to actually look like. And of course, mobilization, building coalitions, and many of the other aspects that are necessary for true change to happen will have to all come together.
Glenda Carr, the climate and environmental conversation is often separate from conversations about housing, jobs, equity, those sorts of things. How do you see them as connected? I mean, racism is everywhere and carbon pollution is everywhere. They're both systemic problems, but they're often thought of as separate.
At the end of the day, you know, we will continue to have siloed conversations. I do think for us to step into this moment where we can truly reimagining an America we can all believe in, we have to look at the intersectionality of this moment. And at the end of the day, Black women want what white women want, who want what Black men want what white men and our other communities of color want. We want economically thriving, educated, and healthy, safe communities. And if we could meet, you know, in the intersection to be able to talk about the nuances of that and why we haven't been able to achieve that. And part of the reason why we haven't been able to achieve that is because of the ability not to have brave conversations about the inequalities in this country. And so what has happened, you know, with the, I think the intersection, when you talk about meeting at the intersection in 2020, we are moving towards a presidential election in November during one of the most politically toxic and racially divisive times. We are in 2020 with the backdrop of COVID-19 and like literally breaking open the racial disparities on mainstream TV and our social platforms about how COVID-19 is impacting communities of color. Then insert, you know, a continued drumbeat on the attack of Blackness, and then insert yet another conversation about the Amy Coopers of the world racializing the ability for a Black man to walk in Central Park as a bird watcher. All of those pieces have now hit an intersection that we can truly have conversations about. How do we talk about the intersectionality of, you know, raising the next generation of whole Americans? And that has to be a connection about my ability to economically thrive, my ability to ensure that my children are educated, to imagine a world where we are all safe, and that it's not just the color of our skin that dictates our ability to walk down the street and not be afraid of not being able to come home.
Mustafa Santiago Ali, you used to work for the Hip Hop Caucus. There's a lot of talk about how Joe Biden needs Black voters to win in 2020. What do you see there and that connection? And does it connect to the issues we're talking about, environment and climate, or have they been pushed aside?
No, I don't think they've been pushed aside at all. So first, let's say for anyone who is garnering to have the vote, especially of the African-American community, then you have to be authentic in the work that you have done in the past, in the present, and actually framing out what your future is going to look like. So if you're not willing to do that, then you're going to have a very difficult time in, you know, gathering those votes that are so critical. You know, the beauty of working at the Hip Hop Caucus, and shout out to Rev Yearwood for helping to, you know, actually found that entity, which was transformational in its moment when it was founded. And of course, today is needed more than ever. Is that you have to reach young people. And one of the ways in being able to accomplish that, of course, is through the arts and making sure that activists and artivists who are actually engaging, learning about the issues, and then sharing that with the masses is a critical component that so many organizations do not get right. And then they wonder why young people, they wonder why people of color are not connected to their work. Well, one, if you don't look like the people who are working in your institution, then you got some work to do. But besides that, you actually have to meet people where they are. Rev and I used to say that our work was from the streets to the suites. So we made sure that we were connecting, you know, with all the various folks that are out there. And, you know, I've shared this before, you know, many of us who are here on this call tonight, you know, we know hundreds, sometimes thousands of incredible scientists who are out there who are doing, you know, important work. And if they say something, you might get 10% of the people to pay attention to what they're saying. But if Beyonce says something, if Jay-Z says something, if Chance the Rapper says something, you know, and a number of other folks are sharing information, it's going to connect because it's coming from an authentic space and they can relate to it. So that's why, you know, organizations like the Hip Hop Caucus, and even in a broader construct, you know, us utilizing and honoring the artists, you know, who are speaking from their hearts, they're speaking from their souls. That's what connects with people. That's what motivates people. And I think that's something also that you see many politicians clamoring to have. But, you know, you got to come from the places. You got to spend time in the places if you want your message to actually resonate in a real and authentic way.
Dr. Bullard, is Joe Biden connecting in a passionate and authentic way? Some people think he doesn't. He's lost a step, doesn't quite have the energy that he used to have. And is he connecting with African-American voters?
Well, let me just put it this way. Black people in this country have never put all of our hope in presidents saving us and have never put all of our hope in white people saving us. And I think it's important that we understand that any politician that's coming for our votes not only need to be authentic, they need to have a track record, and they need to bring people who are from those areas that they want the votes from, and not white people telling us how it feels to be black. The experts that are out there can all tell, you know, a white male can tell on a TV program what a black woman feels. That kind of paternalism and racism and classism needs to stop. So let me just answer your question. I think the fact is that black people are responsible for dragging in South Carolina, dragging Joe Biden across the finish line. Black people are responsible for moving the Democratic Party as far along that it is right now. So let's be clear. When we talk about developing a program of Lift Every Voice, a Black Agenda for America, then that it needs to be more than a 20-page or 30-page term paper. And so we need real, authentic proposals and organizations that have come to the table. That's why a group of us who have been working on environmental justice and environmental racism, transportation, housing, energy, food security, health, et cetera, came together, and we have reformed the National Black Environmental Justice Network, that we are pushing forward an agenda. We have developed policy papers, strategies, and the idea is that if we have a Black Agenda for America that's coming out of the Biden team, then that agenda needs to be developed by and for and presented to that team. And that the way that we move the agenda forward is inclusion, not sloganeering, but real programs. And I think we have enough young people, old people, and people who are concerned about this crisis that we're in right now. 80% of America thinks that we are out of control. Every social movement that has been successful in this country has had students and young people. I spent my life training, educating young people and students. And so the whole idea of getting the word into those elected officials, and it starts at the city council, county commissioner, the legislature, the governor. Everything should not be put just 100% of our energy just on the president election. We have to go down ballot and organize and mobilize and educate. There's no substitution for organizing. We used to be the best organizers in the world, and people learned from us, took our playbook, and now they're mimicking what we used to do. We have to get back to what we used to do, is out-organize everybody. Now that's my spiel for today.
You're listening to a Climate One conversation about racism and climate change. Coming up, addressing the need for more diverse leadership in environmental efforts.
When we look at all the major green groups, we don't see an African-American or a Latinx person leading any of those, but the Heritage Foundation, they actually have an African-American woman who runs that. If they can do it, how is it that these organizations that focus on environmental conservation, climate, can't do it?
That's up next when Climate One continues.